You are going deeper with TGC. Welcome to a special edition of the podcast from the Gospel Coalition. I'm Mark Mellinger. Amid the resurgence of violence in the Middle East, much of it against Christians, we wanted to dig deeper into the religious premises radical groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda have used to justify their acts of terror and genocide. Joining me now to help us get a better grasp on that is a guest I'm calling Al-Fadi. That is an assumed name I am using to protect his identity. He is a former Muslim from Saudi Arabia who converted to Christianity and is also a scholar who has studied the Quran extensively. He has served as a writer, an editor, a translator for several prominent ministries, including Desiring God and many others. So he is uniquely qualified to speak to this. Now, Al, we know that ISIS and other radical groups believe they are living out true Islam when they carry out violence. Is their interpretation in any way legitimate, or is it a modern perversion of Islam?
Well, thank you for this interview, and this is a very important topic. And indeed, the consensus out there lately that we've been hearing over and over on media, and sometimes even from moderate Muslims, that the jihadis like ISIS jihadis or Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab, all of those have basically hijacked Islam and the image of Islam. Unfortunately, even though I do not want to label Muslims in general as the bad people or the jihadis, but the ideology is bad ideology and the theology behind it is bad. And let me be even blunt that the people who ascribe themselves to these groups as Al-Qaeda or ISIS and the likes are actually the true followers and interpreters of what the Quran, the Muslims' holy book, says in terms of how Muslims should behave in terms of spreading the religion and the ideology. So their interpretation, meaning ISIS's interpretation, is accurate interpretation of what they believe and perceive to be the commands from God given to them in their holy book known as the Quran. And this is why we see them behaving the way they're behaving, spreading this terror the way they're doing it, and moving forward and marching forward with their basically plan to spread their faith and expand the territories and the land where they believe should be the land of Islam. And literally, they're fighting everybody in their way, including, as you know, not just so-called Christians or Yazidis, even Muslims who are standing against them. They're being killed and beheaded, and they're fighting them simply because they disagree with their interpretation of these particular teachings and the ideology itself.
Help me understand then how their interpretation differs from that of what I think it's fair to say is most Muslims in the world today, because most Muslims are not going around spouting jihadist ideology and killing people who are not believers. How does their interpretation differ from that of what we would call moderate Muslims?
Well, because the Quran is very clear in its teachings, and we have to understand this. The Quran was revealed in two different stages. The modern Quran that we have in our hand today has 114 chapters. Now, out of those 114 chapters, anywhere between 84 to 86 were revealed in the first phase when the Prophet of Islam declared himself to be a messenger from God. That would have been between the year 610 AD until the year 622 AD, where he was living in Mecca, the same town that is known today as Mecca, where the Grand Mosque exists. Those passages, those surahs or chapters, do not have any commands of violence. Simply put, the reason why they lacked them, because Muhammad at that time did not have enough support, enough followers, to be able to forcibly spread his ideology and his supposed teachings and religion. When he moved from Mecca in the year 622 AD into the town that we know today as Medina, also north of Mecca, about 200 miles north of Mecca, both of them are found, by the way, in modern-day Saudi Arabia. When he moved over there, all of a sudden, he had a lot of Arabs rally around him. They were pagan people and in his days. They accepted him as a prophet. They believed in his message. They believed and endorsed his religion. And they accepted the God that he was promoting and even the scripture that he was presenting to them. And all of a sudden, he found himself with thousands now of followers and even more later that were added to his camp. So he's no longer just the messenger who had about 100 followers. He's now a messenger from God and also a political leader. And in order for him as a political leader to provide for this new nation, the Muslim nation, he also have to find ways for them to raise the money, basically. And one of the ways that were used, according to Islamic own, by the way, biography and own traditions, they were raiding caravans and looting them. And the excuse for that was, well, the people of Mecca kicked us out of Mecca. Therefore, as a punishment, God is asking us now to steal their products and their merchandise, and therefore it becomes ours. And if we capture any of them, they become our slave. And if they're women, we can even sleep with them if we choose to, or we can sell the women and the men that we have captured as slaves and make money that way. This is how the ideology evolved. So in the Quran, we find the verses that were revealed in this second phase in Medina, which lasted from 622 until the death of the prophet in 632 AD. We find now commands for violent, commands to attack, commands to kill. I mean, I'm just going to read you one of those commands. In chapter 2, verses 191 to 193, it says, "And kill them wherever you find them." Talking about the infidels in general, the pagans. Another command in the same chapter, chapter 2, which was revealed in the Medina phase, the second phase, verse 244, "Then fight in the cause of Allah and know that Allah hears and knows all things." The same chapter, chapter 2, verse 216, "Fighting is prescribed for you." I mean, and I can go on and on and on with the list of these commands that were given to the Muslim followers of Muhammad of that time. These are the verses that people like ISIS would look at and say, it's open-ended command. It doesn't have any limitation whatsoever. It is actually prescriptive, not just descriptive to an event that happened 14 centuries ago. It is an open-ended command, and the Quran says actually to all Muslims, not just the fighters and the jihadis, all Muslims, the Quran commands them to obey God, to obey the teaching of the Prophet, and to obey the teachings who know the law, which is the interpreters of the Quran. So ISIS have their own religious leaders who interpret these passages for them and tell them that it's absolutely okay to go and fight. Many Islamic Sharia law judges and commentators of the Quran in the history of Islam in the last 14 centuries agree with what I'm telling you. It just baffles me when I hear things like, oh, these are wrong interpretations. Since when? Since when it's wrong? Just because it's embarrassing right now, and now we have social media and YouTube that exposes these things, it is no longer now valid? Well, how come we don't find, by the way, a lot of moderate Muslims, which I have no doubt that there is at least 85 to 90% of the Muslims in the world are moderates, and I agree with what you said earlier, Mark, that it is not their view to spread jihad and killings and everything else. How come this majority, the vast majority of them, don't stand on CNN, Fox News, and defend their faith in the face of these atrocities that are being committed? If you ask them why, they'll tell you, well, these people of ISIS are crazy. They'll kill me if I do something like this. So they're too are victims of the same ideology they adhere to.
And, okay, so you're saying that the radical Muslims, that's what they're called by the media, that's how most of us would refer to ISIS and Al-Qaeda, view those surahs that prescribe violence, they view them as prescriptive. Is it a difference of interpretation in the sense that moderate Muslims would look at those passages and their teachers would look at those passages and say, no, those are descriptive, or they were limited for in terms of duration to a specific time and place in history? Is that the difference between the two groups?
That's the main difference, but I can assure you, brother, that If you look at the history of Islam, these verses have always been interpreted as prescriptive, just like we in the church. We look at an issue, we look at a doctrine, and we view how historically the church and the church fathers have interpreted those verses. The same thing happens in the camp of Islam. Historically, these religious leaders will look at how all of these Muslim scholars in the history of Islam in the last 14 centuries interpreted such a thing. Even some of these scholars will scoff, basically, and laugh at what they hear from other Islamic scholars when they say those are just descriptive, because they know that that's the minority, basically, opinion, not the majority opinion, in terms of the Islamic scholars community.
I remember President Bush saying after 9/11 that true Islam is a religion of peace. As somebody who grew up a Muslim in Saudi Arabia and was a Muslim for decades before becoming a Christian, I take it from what you've said, you would disagree with that characterization.
I would disagree with that characterization when Islam is not the dominant religion. Islam is a religion of peace when it's dominant in an area, when it is the law of the land. I lived and I came from Saudi Arabia. Islam was a religion of peace over there. Why? Because it was the constitution of the land. The leadership adhered to it. Sharia law is applied everywhere. Islam was enforced everywhere. So it was peaceful, because no one was standing against it. But Islam is not a religion of peace when it is the minority, when it is oppressed, or when it's trying to fight to gain that power, as we are witnessing, for instance, right now in Iraq and Syria.
And a couple last things here. Are the aims of ISIS when it comes to taking over territory in the Middle East really solely grounded in religion, in your opinion, or is there more to the story? I mean, are factors like the pursuit of power, wealth, and economic control also fueling this violence?
Absolutely. I agree with your observation. And let me say this. Yes, the ideology is definitely the main fuel, but there is also other motives. It is the political power and everything that comes with it, all the benefits that come with becoming a leader, basically, or part of the elite leadership, if you wish. And of course, they're trying to capture oil fields because they know the power in this. Even in Afghanistan, ironically, you know, when the Taliban were ruling, they were actually selling drugs, which is prohibited in Islam, completely prohibited. But they would use excuses from the law to try to justify that the end justifies the mean in order for them to make money. This is the only mean that we have to be able to do so. So if you look at it, we hear all this rhetoric all the time that Islam is anti-Israel and Islam doesn't like the Jewish people and Israel has occupied the land of the Muslim people. Well, my question is this. Why is ISIS not turning to the direction of Israel right now? Because they fear doing so, because they know Israel will annihilate them overnight, basically. So all of what they're doing is they're creating terror in the hearts of their own people in other Islamic countries, in Jordan, in Saudi, in Iraq, in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon. But dare they attack at least Israel, and they know that what's going to come next is annihilation, basically.
Why and how do these radical groups gain followers in the first place?
There is a lot of reasons. If we look at the pool where they are drawing from these fighters, you have one class, and that's the locals. They started it basically with locals in Syria and Iraq who were marginalized basically by these governments for the longest time. So obviously, it's a sectarian difference and a political reason. That's not one pool. The second pool comes from countries like Saudi Arabia, for instance, and other Islamic countries where the youth, the young men basically, also have been marginalized. Many of them are educated, but they don't have jobs. They can't get married. They have no money, basically, to provide for a family. And all of a sudden, you have ISIS saying, come on over, we'll give you a car, we'll give you a phone, we'll give you even a leadership role, and you're actually fulfilling a command that is given to you in the Quran. And if you win, you get these spoils, and you get a woman, you know, to become yours and get slaves. And if you die, you're going straight to heaven and having 72 virgins, and the list can go on and on and on. And then the third class that they are recruiting from are the people from Europe, basically, as you hear, from Britain, from France, from Australia, from the U.S., who are mainly converts or at least second generations that have never lived in an Islamic country. They live this fantasy that Islam is a religion of peace, never experienced real life under Islamic Sharia law. And some of them are converts, don't understand Arabic, the language of the Quran, and they just rely on the interpretation of their leaders. So they're being misled, without a doubt. So that's how they can capitalize on all of this. Many of them who are converts, they believe that, hey, this is a new exciting thing right now, so this is my calling now to jihad. So they basically accept the calling as well.
Do you see this as a time of primarily great peril or primarily great opportunity for Christianity in the Middle East right now?
It's both. I think the church is getting a real awakening here and over there in the Middle East. I think one of the reasons why we're seeing many young men who convert to Islam is the lack of discipleship in the church to begin with, and the lack of emphasis on evangelism to reach out to these immigrants with the gospel and to reach out to these young men and women who are born here, who go to church and sometimes don't even understand what is the doctrine of the Trinity. What is the doctrine of inerrancy? They lack understanding of simple things, basically. So the church hasn't done its work, basically, universally, if you wish.
Okay, so you're not just talking about in the Middle East. You're talking about in Europe, here in North America, everywhere. Evangelism and discipleship have not been done thoroughly, at least in broad strokes.
Absolutely, sir. Absolutely. This is why we find many of these converts that come from Europe who claim that they were Christians. Some of them will say, I used to go to church. I used to attend here and there, you know. So what a shame that, that they attend a church, but they weren't convinced that Jesus is Lord and Savior. I mean, that's the bottom line, basically. And the other thing, of course, God always turns things always to be good. I mean, all things work together for good, basically. That's what the Bible teaches. So I think this is an opportunity for the church right now to begin to extend that grace to the Muslim community here and there as well. It is the church that are reaching out, basically, to the Syrian refugees everywhere. It is the church that are trying to extend that grace to them. But I pray also that the church will also share the gospel with them here and there. The church will reach out to the Muslim generations that are living as immigrants, as students in our backyard, to help them see for themselves. If they are dissatisfied, as they say, with what ISIS is doing, then we need to present an alternative to them so that they are not making up a new Islamic religion in their own mind, a neo-Islam, if you wish. So in other words, we want them to know that even if you disagree with ISIS, Islam is not the way. Islam is still not the way to heaven. There is an alternative that you have to hear about.
Al-Fadi, we appreciate your unique insights, brother. Thank you for setting aside the time.
You're welcome, brother.
You've been going deeper with TGC.